Chapter 11. They drove due south toward Carson City and soon passed an enormous body of water.
"Now that's a sight for sore eyes,"
said Callahan,
"considering we're in the middle of a desert."
"Lake Tahoe," said Archer, as the Delahaye whizzed past it on State Route 27.
"How do you know that?"
"Read a travel brochure." She eyed the dashboard.
"Does this thing have a radio?"
"Afraid not," said Archer. 1939 apparently was a long time ago.
"I like George Burns and Gracie Allen. They make me laugh. And they seem to really love each other, even though they're married."
"Well, that's sort of the point, isn't it?"
"What you don't know could fill a library, Archer."
"What I don't get is how come on this show Gracie always outsmarts George."
"Well, they just like to keep it realistic."
They crossed into California and then dog-legged southwest before entering the Sierra Nevada Mountains. As the ground rose swiftly around them, Callahan clutched the edge of her seat.
"You okay?" asked Archer.
"I didn't know we had to go through mountains to get there."
"You ever been to California before?"
"Never. You?"
"When I was in the Army. Trained at Fort Ord, and then at Camp San Luis Obispo."
As they passed close to the edge of a long drop, she closed her eyes and said,
"Well, I prefer flat land."
"Well, with the right-hand drive and the direction we're going, I'm the one close to the edge, not you."
"I'm close enough, thank you very much."
They drove past slopes full of chaparral, flatter lands of grass savannas, stands of big-leaf maples and white alders, thick, rugged, live black and blue oaks, and armies of coulter pines.
"What the hell kind of tree is that?"
asked Callahan. They were passing what looked to be a whole forest of them. They seemed to reach to the stars, and an army column, complete with armor, could have ridden through an opening in one broad trunk. "Giant sequoias, biggest trees there are. We came up here to train a few times, ended up just staring at those suckers for about an hour." They started upward again with jarring swiftness, and Callahan clamped her eyes shut.
"How'd you end up in Reno?"
asked Archer, trying to draw her mind away from the ascending elevation. She slowly opened her eyes.
"After the war, I wasn't sure what to do. My brother was dead, and my parents both died before the war started. The factory I worked in closed down, and with all the boys coming back from fighting, there weren't any jobs left for the women. Those who were married went back to their homes and husbands, those who came back anyway. I worked at a diner in Tennessee for a bit, then decided to just pull up stakes and totally change the direction of my life."
"So you headed west?"
"Yes, like a lot of people."
She eyed him with a heavy-lidded look.
"Like you."
"And the stint at the Dancing Birds Cafe?"
"I got to Reno and was wandering around town, checking things out when I literally bumped into Mr. Shiner. I guess he liked the looks of me. I started out working as the hostess, prancing around in my tight little gown, getting my butt pinched and my boobs felt up and taking dollar tips from the gents for the privilege. Then I became a waitress. The tips were better, and the ass pinchers had a tougher angle to work with. But I couldn't see a future in it. I was practicing my dancing and singing the whole time, though, you see. Out in Hollywood, the girls have to be able to do lots of things. I read about that in magazines. If I can sing and dance, I can get parts. Bit parts, sure. But then people get to know you, and your roles get bigger. That's how it works. And if you're lucky enough and work hard enough, you get to be a star."
"Sounds like you gave this a lot of thought," replied Archer.
"You have to give it thought when you're changing your whole life."
Archer considered this.
"I'm not sure I gave my course change a lot of thinking. It was sort of a spur-of-the-moment thing."
"Oh, I couldn't afford to do that, Archer. This is my last chance at something big."
"Why? You're still young?"
"In the movie business, I'm getting close to middle age. I need to get going before the only parts left to me are playing the heroine's spinster aunt."
"Mm-hmm."
Archer checked the mirror. She noticed this and said,
"You don't think we're being followed?"
"Never can be too careful."
They passed over the San Joaquin River and watched the rushing water below. It was the fourth such river they'd crossed. It seemed to Archer that California was a very well-hydrated state. It grew dark as they continued heading south through the San Joaquin Valley, which was flat and filled with plants of every description, and all lush and green.
So, are we done with the mountains?
Asked Callahan, looking relieved.
This place is pretty level.
Valleys usually are, but no, we're not. We have to go through the Diablo Range next, noted Archer.
Then is that it for the mountains?
No, there's a whole mess of coastal ranges north to south. After Diablo, we cross the Santa Lucia Range to get to Baytown, which is where I'm going.
Lots of Spanish names in California,
she said suspiciously. Well, they did discover it first.
Where are we stopping for the night?
She asked as she lit up a cigarette and nervously blew smoke to her side of the car. There's a place called Coalinga in Fresno County. Route 198 will take us there.
Never heard of Coalinga.
Neither have I, but it's a place to stop.
Do we go through the Diablo Mountains to get there?
No, it's still pretty much in the valley. It's farmland, mostly level.
How much farther after Coalinga to Baytown?
On these sorts of roads, I'm not sure. We cross the Diablos, head for the coast, and then go south for a way, cross the Santa Lucias, and then go straight for the Pacific. It'd be good if we could make it in one trip, but I'm getting pretty tired, and it's another 3 hours just to Coalinga.
Then why don't you pull over and rest your eyes at least? I don't want us running off a cliff because you're beat.
He found a rest area on the side of the road that had a small picnic table and an old rusted charcoal grill. They sat at the table with their coats wrapped around them, since the sinking sun had brought drastically cooler temps, and the winds funneled down the valley had picked up. Callahan had brought a paper sack of sandwiches, and they ate one each and split a fat pickle. As they smoked their cigarettes, and Callahan took a pull on Archer's flask, he said, We'll need to gas up again. We can do that in Coalinga, and maybe we can get a cup of coffee.
Or a slug of gin.
Right. Then we're good until we get to Baytown.
And you can be a private eye,
said Callahan.
Or die trying.
Archer glanced over at her. And you can go to Hollywood and be a movie star. And ditto. She looked over at the Delahaye admiringly.
Nice ride so far.
Except for the mountains, you mean?
I'm getting used to them, actually. I can learn to accept pretty much anything.
That's real good, lady, because you're going to have to. They looked up to see three men standing there. Chapter 12. Archer stared over at the trio of intruders. One guy was small, but he stood in front of the other two. He was clearly the leader. Archer sized up the pair as the necessary muscle on a mission of this kind. They were built like pickup trucks, and their expressions betrayed as much intellect as an exhaust pipe. The little fellow was dapperly dressed in a beige serge suit with two-tone shoes, black and gray, toe to heel, and a white felt hat with a black band and ribbon. The hair Archer could see around the temples was slick, just like the facial features. The eyes were dulled ball bearings. His waistcoat was dark gray and matched the shoe color. His tie was dark red and knotted in the double Windsor style. He had a straight line of mustache above a thin, chapped top lip. It looked waxed. He looked waxed. The pair of strong arms was outfitted in 46 long pinstripes that still looked squeezed by their bulk. Tweedledee held a 45 loosely at the side of his hammy thigh. His partner in crime cradled a far more menacing Remington side-by-side sawed-off shotgun in his hands like a newborn. They both had matching fedoras, light blue with black bands, and no ribbons thereon. The boss took a step forward, and the big boys did likewise. The menace in their features was palpable. Archer rose from the picnic table while Callahan remained in her seat, staring at the men. "Hello, fellas, you lost?" said Archer by way of greeting. He pointed to his right. The Pacific's that way, at least I think. The little man snickered, and then apparently thought better of it, and his features turned nasty. We know exactly where we are. If anybody's lost, it's you two. He aimed a finger at Archer, and then Callahan for emphasis that wasn't needed. The shotgun and the 45 did that just fine. We know where we are and where we're going, said Archer. Tweedledee's twin brought the sawed off up and leveled it at Archer's belly. Archer wasn't prepared to fight a Remington with his bare hands. He couldn't outrun Buckshot, and assuming the fetal position seemed like a lousy idea too. The fact is, Mac, you ain't going anywhere, said the little man.
Archer glanced at Callahan to see her gaze still holding on the three men. She seemed concerned but not desperate. Archer didn't quite know how to read that.
Is there something you want? Asked Archer, his gaze now swiveling between the little man and the Remington.
The night air was suddenly thick with the choking smells of the eucalyptus trees, and the chaparral seemed to close upon them like a band of hungry wolves. If Archer dared close his eyes, he could be back in the European theater, on the outskirts of another village, the names of which he could never pronounce. He would be creeping along, he and two buddies, M1s in hand, sig packs in their pockets, dog tags dangling from quivering necks, equal parts hope and dread in their hearts, just wanting to finish the mission of the moment and get back to safety, if there was any to be had in the middle of a world war.
The dapper fellow pointed to the Delahay. Archer followed the finger. You want the car?
What a smart guy you are.
There was no joviality behind the remark, only stark insult.
Archer eyed the muscle. There was nothing behind their eyes. They were here to dispose of a nuance, two nuances.
You've been following us, right?
Ever since you left Reno. Wasn't that hard. Roads like this, you can only go one way, probably why you never eyed us.
Reno, really?
Yeah, really.
You happen to know somebody named Robert Howells?
The man grinned.
He was the one who told us you were heading to California. This was after we roughed him up a little, made it easy to follow you. It was one of my guys who put the ding in that car last night, and you ruined my Buick, pal. You owe me for that. I'm here to collect.
Okay, but why do you want the car? Howells was going to pay you off with the money he got for it.
Yeah, thing is, he owed me a lot more than he got from you.
How do you know how much he got from me?
The man pulled out a wad of cash.
Because as soon as he left you, I took it from him and counted it. He owes another $6,000. I figure the car will make up the difference.
He didn't mention owing you that much. If he did, I'm surprised he let the car go for what I gave him.
The thing is, old Bobby H. must have forgot to add in the interest. At 100% a day, it adds up quick.
Yeah, I bet. And where is Howells now? Asked Archer, his face starting to tingle. The man gave him a forced grin.
You ain't that stupid, are you?
You didn't have to kill him, you know.
I don't remember asking for your opinion.
Callahan broke the silence.
If you take the car, how the hell do we get out of here?
Archer couldn't believe the woman was serious with her question, and when he looked over at her, he could tell by her expression that she wasn't. Maybe she was stalling for time, allowing Archer to come up with a plan. What a disappointment he would be for her.
That won't be a problem for you, said the little man.
Well, I don't find that acceptable, said Callahan.
Archer almost laughed at this comment, but when he looked at her, the thought of humor faded. The little man seemed to want to say something, but the words stalled in his throat. He just shrugged, lit a half-smoked cigarillo, and contemplated the dirt for a few moments.
Take the car, said Archer, and we can walk to where we're going.
The muzzle of the cigarillo came up and pointed in Archer's direction. Like the Remington, it seemed a direct threat to his personal well-being.
Archer added, We don't know you from Adam. You'll be long gone before we reach a telephone box or a cop. Why make two bodies if you don't have to? Stealing a car is one thing. The other is something else. The gas chamber at San Quentin is a shitty way to kick it.
Smoke curled off the end of the cigarillo and lifted to the sky, like a fragment of a memory gone to heaven. Archer looked up at the sky, and when his gaze came back down, the little man was staring dead at him.
No can do, pal. I never did like loose ends.
Archer felt his adrenaline actually ease for some reason. This unusual physiological reaction in the face of danger came from his fighting in the war. If you wanted to live, you had to remain calm. He moved to his left, drawing the attention and angle of attack of the thugs.
Don't try to run, said the little man. It won't matter, and you'll just embarrass yourself, Mac.
I don't remember asking for your opinion, said Archer. And just so you know, the outer killing range on a sawed-off is about 6 feet. I'm double that.
He eyed the .45. And in the dark, that revolver is bumping against the wall of accuracy at 10 feet. He took a long stride backward.
and now I'm at 15 feet.
Son, don't end your time looking like a fool, said the little man somberly. Have some self-respect and let's get this over with nice and clean.
Archer moved in a slow curve, and they curved with him. Sawed-Off, perhaps sensing a loss of control of the situation, took a few quick strides forward.
Still not enough, said Archer.
The buckshot will sting, but it won't kill.
He didn't really believe this, but then he didn't have to. Now 45 moved forward, joining his twin along the line of attack. The little man, sensing the end coming, took a step back, burned off the remnants of his smoke, and dropped it to the dirt. The orange embers winked dead in the darkness like a miniature sun burrowing into the horizon.
Now just hold still, said 45,
his voice surprisingly high-pitched for such a big larynx. He took aim with the revolver, but Archer could see his dominant arm shaking like a twig in a breeze. 45 clearly wanted to be big and tough, but maybe he was just big. Archer kept moving for two more strides, turning the men's attention even more fully to him. What they hadn't foreseen was that his movements had put their backs to Callahan. They seemed to have forgotten all about the woman. That was about to change, but not exactly in the way Archer intended. Callahan fired, and her 38th round hit Sawed-Off right in the shoulder blade. He grunted once as the slug penetrated first skin, then tendon, then severed bone, and plowed right through an intersection of blood vessels. He groped around, pawing with his free hand at the entry wound and screaming in pain. His hat came off and landed in the pool of blood now avalanching from him, for the shot had split a fat artery right in two. Snot blew out of his nose in his rage and fear and pain. He threw up whatever he'd last eaten and drunk, fouling the air. A urine stain emerged around his zipper as the shock of the rounds hitting him overcame his ability to hold this bodily function in check. His fingers lost their strength, and the Remington hit the hard dirt. The impact with the ground must have sprung its filed-down hair triggers, because the twin barrels of the Sawed-Off boomed sideways and caught 45 at both ankles, with hundreds of pebbles of angry buckshot at a distance of about 7 inches, severing that part of his body as neat as a bone saw, and miraculously leaving him upright. At that range, the Sawed-Off wasn't a gun, it was a bomb. The big man looked down and saw that his black wingtips and the feet in them were resting next to him instead of under him. He was suddenly 3 inches shorter and standing on twin shattered bone tips, and his mind didn't seem able to cope with this because he made no sound. He toppled sideways but fired his gun, maybe as a knee-jerk reaction. He killed a eucalyptus tree next to Archer. 45 commenced dying as he lay on the ground, probably not knowing who or what had killed him. Archer watched as the man turned to him, his hemorrhaging eye an inch above the forest floor. The man blinked once, then shock took over. He convulsed once, then again, and the eye closed, and the man died quick and silent. Archer knew that pulling the trigger and killing a man was easy. What was hard was everything leading up to that point, and everything coming after it. Archer turned to Sawed-Off. He, too, had left this life in a dark burgundy spread of blood that the dirt did not seem to want, because it lay on top of the ground like water in a pool.
Don't!
The voice barked out. Archer turned to see Callahan, now pointing her Smith & Wesson at the little man, who, dazed by the sudden elimination of his comrades, had pulled a .22 Derringer from his waistcoat, was pointing it around, though Archer could tell the fellow had no firm idea of an actual target.
Don't do it,
Callahan said. Her voice was assured, in command, with an ice-in-the-veins sort of rhythm. It was like a dagger needling your ribs before it went in for the kill. Archer looked at her. Unlike 45, there wasn't a twitch in her gun hand. The Smith & Wesson was held as sure and steady as a foot-round oak branch in still air. Callahan's features looked like the mountain peaks they'd passed, chiseled, foreboding, impenetrable. The last one got to Archer the most, confounding him. The little man dropped the Derringer and backed away from it, his hands palm up in front of him, as though that would matter against the .38.
Okay, he said. a line of sweat glistening around the whiskers above his lip. Don't do nothing crazy, lady.
You mean, kill you? Like you were going to kill us? So who's crazy?
Please, lady, he moaned.
Don't please me,
she retorted.
It's a little late for that.
Archer said, It's over, Liberty. Just let him go. She spoke without looking at him.
And let him do what? Keep following us? Tell somebody else what happened? I killed a man, Archer.
In self-defense.
I shot him in the back.
I'm your witness to what happened. The little man said, He's talking sense, and all the fight's gone right out of me. Wish I'd never come up here. I'll take my money and go. You got my word. Honest to God.
Too late to be talking about God,
snapped Callahan. Just wait a minute, said Archer.
You can't trust guys like this, Archer. They say one thing and do another.
She took closer aim with her revolver.
And he confessed to killing Bobby H.
Archer stepped forward, blocking her sightline. Killing a man in self-defense is one thing. This is something else. And I'm no saint, but I can't be party to something else. So you might as well shoot me first and then him, because I can't let that go.
I like you, Archer, but I'm not sure I like you that much.
Well, keep this in mind. We have more mountains to go over. You want to drive it alone? Go ahead. This did what apparently her conscience could not. She lowered her gun.
Pick up his piece and the shotgun and the revolver.
Archer did as she asked, holding the trio of weapons so their barrels pointed to the dirt.
Where's your car?
Callahan asked the little man. Around the bend back there.
Show us.
He led them around a curve in the road. It was a wonder they hadn't heard the engine, but the wind up here was loud, funneled between the peaks. It was a Chrysler sedan painted an ugly green with the biggest chrome bumper Archer had ever seen. It was large enough for him to take a nap on.
You got a spare tire?
Asked Callahan. Of course, replied the man. She shot out the Chrysler's right front tire, and the air hissed out as the rubber fell flat. She lowered her gun, studied what she'd done, and said,
I still want to shoot him.
I know, said Archer, drawing a sharp look from her. But I say we get back in the car and keep going.
I'll go along with that plan, for now.
She eyed the man, who looked like a fellow who thought he was still on death row.
You follow us? Archer won't save you next time. You go back to where you came from and stay there, and you keep your mouth shut.
She lifted her .38 and took aim at a spot between his ball-bearing eyes. The man backed away. Yes, ma'am. One more thing, said Archer. He walked over to the man and drilled him so hard in the face with his fist that the fellow was lifted off his feet and slammed against the side of the car before crumpling to the dirt. That was for Bobby H. If I ever see you again, I'll be the last thing you ever see. The man sat on the ground holding his broken nose and sobbing in pain. Callahan turned and walked back to the Delahaye.
Let's go, Archer.
Archer stood there for a bit until she was almost out of sight. Then he did just as she said. Chapter 13 The Delahaye prowled through the valley like a muscular river drilling through rock. Archer had placed the weapons they'd taken in the trunk. Both he and Callahan were visibly shaken by what had happened. Archer's mind was going a million miles an hour, and Callahan looked pale and distraught.
I guess you think I'm a bad person,
Callahan said quietly, finally breaking the silence after about 25 minutes of nothing but the French car's purr. I don't think anything one way or another.
Girls have to know how to take care of themselves, Archer. At least this girl does. You think that just applies to guys?
No, but maybe I assume, just like all other guys.
Assume what?
That gunplay is for the men. Clearly I'm wrong about that.
Fact is, my daddy taught me to shoot starting when I was 8 years old. I could barely hold the deer rifle.
He taught you well. I was not an easy shot tonight with the bad light and distance.
He was as big as a barn. If I'd missed that lug, I'd need glasses. And the other guy died from an accident, so that had nothing to do with me.
Archer downshifted as the road began to curve sharply. They put up the car's top because the temperature had dropped and the wind was pushing the cold into them like a railroad spike between the ribs. How about the little man, then? You were going to shoot him in cold blood.
Maybe I was bluffing.
Don't think so. She lit up a Camel and blew a puff of angry smoke at him.
How the hell do you know? How the hell do you know anything about me?
I've seen you gamble. You don't have a poker face. She gave him a sideways glance that Archer, who was doing the same to her, felt to his toes. He wasn't sure how to properly read the situation, mainly because he'd never met a woman like Callahan before. So is that my fault or hers? With an exhale of Camel smoke, followed by a brush at her hair with a shaky index finger, she said,
Do we have to tell anybody about it?
I think there might be trouble if we don't. She cranked her window down and flicked her Camel away. It caught a shaft of wind and glanced off an oak before sinking into the asphalt. She cranked the glass back up. Archer continued. But we have to think this through. They're going to find the bodies. It was at a picnic area. Folks are going to stop there just like we did. They're going to unwrap their sandwiches, take out the potato salad, pour coffee out of the thermos, and then look around and start puking.
Maybe the other guy will get rid of the bodies,
she said. Why would he do that?
He's got exposure too, Archer. He's a criminal, not us. We were just protecting ourselves.
Archer shook his head. I told Howells to get the hell out of Reno, and now he's dead. She shot him a look.
So I say, we forget it happened, and if anybody asks, we don't know anything. Two murderers are dead. So what? They got what they deserved.
He glanced at her purse. Well, no matter what, you might want to do something with the Smith and Wesson then.
Why?
Because your slug's in the man's back, that's why. They can match bullets. And speaking of, we need to get rid of the guns in the trunk. She started to bite at a nail painted bright green until it bled as she thought about this.
We still stopping at Coalinga?
Right now I feel like I'm never going to close my eyes again. But we need gas, and I need some coffee. And staying someplace feels like the right thing to do. We both can sort of calm down.
Can I have a pull on your flask?
He worked it free from his pocket and passed it across. She took a healthy swallow, sucked her lips inward in satisfaction, and recapped the flask.
That's better. You want a shot?
She asked, holding it out. I've had enough shots for today, thanks. He pointed to the river rushing parallel to the road. That's a good spot to dump them.
Okay, Archer, go ahead. But not my gun. We might need it in case that guy comes after us again.
He got out, grabbed the shotgun, Derringer, and 45 from the trunk, walked down to the riverbank, and tossed them all in. He watched them float for a few moments in the strong current, and then they were gone, like fog in the heat of a rising sun. He walked to the car, got back on the road, and sped up.
You feel better?
She asked. Yeah. How about you? In a tone he had not heard her use before, she said,
I killed a man back there, Archer. I'm not sure I'll ever feel right again.
He saw her hands suddenly start to shake, and the muscles around her throat tense. Sweat bubbles rose up on her forehead. He quickly pulled off the road, leaned over, and opened the door. Go ahead, do it out there, quick. She jumped out and ran behind a tree, and he could hear her being violently sick. She came back a couple minutes later, rubbing at her mouth. Then she got into the car and shut the door. You okay? She nodded, but still looked unwell. Sometimes there's a delayed reaction, like your mind can't wrap itself around something right away.
Yeah.
They were going to kill us, Liberty, like you said. She pressed her face against the cool glass, closed her eyes, and exhaled a long breath.
Yeah. Now just shut up and drive.
Chapter 14. Coalinga wasn't a thriving metropolis, nor was it the one-horse town Archer thought it was going to be. Liberty eyed the welcome sign.
Where'd they get the name Coalinga? Is it Spanish?
He pointed to his right. There's a railroad spur over there, and those are loaded coal cars, so maybe there's your answer. It was nearly 10 o'clock, and the town seemed to be sound asleep, with no one out and most of the buildings closed up. I don't know if we can get gas or coffee now, or we might end up sleeping in the car till morning, said Archer. Because the filling station over there is shut down for the night, and this doesn't look like a two-gas pump kind of town.
There's a light on in that building over there.
They stopped in front and climbed out. The air was cool and dry, and the wind had died down some. Archer slipped on his hat and locked up the delay. The sign out front of the building read, Clancy's Saloon. Open at noon, close whenever.
I like Kolinga better already,
said Callahan as she saw this too. Archer held the door for her and they walked in. The 400 square feet inside consisted of a mahogany bar with 10 backless stools, a jukebox with neon tubes blinking wearily, 4 tables with a pair of low-backed chairs designed in the form of a ship's wooden wheel around each, a small dance floor made of scratched herringbone parquet on which not a soul was dancing, and a payphone on the wall. A pencil dangled from a string tacked to that wall, and lines of phone numbers had been scribbled across the paint like math equations. A small window behind the bar was where the food came through for the patrons seated there. A single swing door to the left of that was where the meals came through for the dining area. 2 men sat at the bar, one young and lean, one old and spreading. They both held mugs of beer, and both looked to be listing to the right in alcoholic zeal. Behind the wooden counter was a beefy man with curly red hair, a stained white apron, and shirt sleeves rolled up to reveal twin anchor tattoos, one on each forearm. A cigar was clamped on one side of his wide, toothy mouth. He was staring down at the cloth in his hand like he was wondering how it had gotten there. Of the 4 tables, only one was occupied. On one side was a woman in her 50s with white hair and a long, horsey face. Her cherry-red purse sat on the table next to her plate of raw oysters on the half-shell, and a bourbon, neat, percolating in a short glass. Across from her was a gentleman, also in his 50s, suited in a 3-piece worsted wool with a loosened dark tie. He was chubby and sweaty, and his napkin was pinned across his white shirt front like a bullseye. A plate of spaghetti and clams lay in front of him, and he methodically worked his fork and spoon in tandem as he ate. He had a glass of red wine as his meal's liquid companion. At first, no one looked up when they walked in. Then Chubby with the clam saw Callahan and made such a fuss that White Hair turned to see. Her long face became pinched and sour. She turned back to her table mate and said something low, snappy, and apparently pointed as a spear, because the clams once more became Chubby's sole focus. The bartender looked up, saw Callahan, grabbed a glass, and started polishing it to a fine sheen, a sloppy grin spreading across his face, as though he'd just won a prize that would take him away from here. The young drunk turned, eyed Callahan, and almost fell off his stool. The old drunk would probably have done likewise, but he had already fallen face first into the mahogany and was now snoring. The swinging door did its thing, and a woman in her 20s with sandy brown hair and short muscular legs, and attired in a light brown waitress uniform with faded red piping, came out carrying a platter of clean glasses. She saw them and pointed with her free hand to a table.
Have a seat. Be with you folks in a sec.
Archer and Callahan sat, and after the waitress deposited the glasses in a double-door wooden cabinet, she came over with menus and cloth napkins folded around cutlery. She handed it all out and said,
Can I get you something to drink? If you want food, the kitchen closes in 20 minutes.
Then we must be getting close to whenever, noted Archer.
Yeah. You're the first person to come up with that line,
she said in a bored tone. I'll have coffee, Black, said Archer. You folks know how to make a gimlet?
Yes, we've done those before.
Great. Then a gimlet chaser for the coffee, and go easy on the roses, and let the gin make its mark for me. Or do I tell that to the friendly behind the bar?
I'll give him the order,
she said as she turned to Callahan.
And you, ma'am? You got cranberry juice?
Asked Callahan.
Yes. Is that all you want? Yeah, so long as it goes with the vodka.
The woman grinned and gave Archer a condescending look.
Now that's wit, buckaroo. I'll get your drinks.
Archer took his hat off and set it on the table. He looked around the room. He'd been in bars better than this and lousier than this. The same alcohol was served here that was dished out in the best bars in the world. L.A., New York, Paris, London, and Berlin— what was left of it. So in that respect, a bar in Kolinga, California, was as good as any of those.
but Archer was still in Kolinga, and not Paris. Callahan slipped out a Camel and tapped the lighting end on the hard surface to make the tobacco as good as it could be.
"You think that little goon headed back to Reno?"
she said. Archer shrugged. "Maybe. He's out of guns and bigger goons. I don't see him following us alone."
"He might still come after us with some other muscle."
"Good luck finding us. California's a pretty big place."
"That's true,"
she replied, her spirits seeming to lift. They sat there in silence until his coffee and gimlet came along with her cocktail. The waitress pulled out her pad and pen.
"You folks had a chance to look over the menu? No more oysters and no more clams, by the way."
"What would you recommend?" asked Archer.
"The steak. We got 2 pieces left. And baked potato. We got 2 of those left, too."
"Steak and potatoes. Why didn't I think of that?"
said Callahan.
"Sold."
"Make it a deuce," added Archer. The waitress went off. Archer drank down the rest of his coffee and turned his attention to the gimlet. Callahan shot him a nervous glance.
"You're looking pensive again, Archer."
"You still want to go on to Hollywood?" She gave him a pointed look that seemed to peek right into his soul. She finished a long drag on her smoke before saying,
"That was the original plan. You see any reason why I should change it?"
"Yeah, 2 of them. Same as the number of bodies we left up in the mountains."
"Do we have to go over that again?"
"Hear me out."
"Okay."
She sat back and crossed one long leg over the other, which rode her skirt way up, and commenced jiggling her foot, letting her high heel dangle precariously off her toes. Chubby glanced over and saw this, and seemed to whimper before his companion kicked him under the table. "It might be better if we stuck together, at least for a while."
"You mean, if he comes after us with more goons?"
"Yeah."
"But you said he wouldn't be able to find us, Archer."
"I know I did, but I've been thinking about that. I'm not sure I didn't let it slip when I was in Reno about where I was headed. And the Delahaye sort of sticks out. And if you go to Hollywood and start making a name for yourself, he sure as hell knows what your name is. He would have gotten it from Howells. Mine too."
"But then should we go to Baytown? If he knows that's where you'll be?"
"I have to, Liberty. I want a shot at this job. And I told the guy I'd be coming." Archer now looked uncertain. "But maybe you shouldn't go to Baytown. Maybe you should go to Hollywood. But change your name. All those folks do, right?"
"But if I get in pictures, he'll recognize me, even if I change my name. Hell, he might even try to blackmail me."
Archer nodded slowly. "That's true. So what do you want to do?"
"I think we should stay together,"
she said,
"and go to Baytown. I can hang around long enough to see if the guy shows up."
"But you don't have to do that. You can go lie low somewhere else."
"And leave you all by your lonesome? What kind of a fink do you think I am?"
They sat in silence until their meals came. Archer was lost in thought, and Callahan was lost in more camels. They ate and put down money for their bill. When the waitress came over to collect it, Archer asked if there was a place to stay the night.
"Yes, it's right down the street, called the Kolinga House. They do overnights, and they have vacancies right now. Not Card. They might have gone to bed. Mildred Hawks is the owner's name. She's nice. Tell her Katie sent you."
They walked out, got into the Delahaye, and drove the short distance to the Kolinga House. It was a broad plank and brick building, with a porch down the front and a row of rocking chairs lined up like toy soldiers alongside little pots with fresh flowers. There was a concrete statue of a kitten playing cute on the first step up to the porch.
"Well, at least it doesn't look like a place where we can get into too much trouble, Archer."
The door was painted red, and Archer had to pound on it for a full minute before they heard footsteps pecking on the floor toward them. The door opened, and there stood, presumably, Mildred. She was in her 60s with long braided gray hair flipped over one granny-robed shoulder. She looked sleepy and annoyed at the same time.
"Yes."
"We need a place to stay," said Archer. "Just got in town. Katie at Clancy's recommended you. I'm assuming you're Mildred?" Mildred nodded warily and then eyed Callahan with a severe eye.
"I've only got one room available."
Callahan said,
"One is all we need."
"Then you're married,"
she said.
We're driving in from Reno. Who goes to Reno except to get hitched?
Mildred's gaze swept down to their hands.
And where are your rings, then?
Callahan's expression turned to one of despair.
Can you believe it? We were robbed on the way. We've reported it, but the police don't hold out much hope.
If you were just married, you must have your certificate.
That was with the things that were stolen,
said Callahan mournfully.
Along with something borrowed and something blue. Crappy way to start a honeymoon, huh? I've had to work hard not to cry my eyes out.
The stream of lies so confidently told seemed to soften Mildred up. She opened the door wider.
I have a place at the top of the stairs. Bathroom down the hall.
That sounds perfect,
replied Callahan. She turned to Archer.
Well, honey?
Well, what? Said Archer.
Aren't you going to carry me over the threshold?
She looked at Mildred.
Men, right? They're like little boys who have to be constantly told to blow their noses and to lift the seat on the toilet.
Mildred gave her a knowing look and stepped back out of the way.
Okay, young man. Go ahead. Do your duty.
He picked Callahan up effortlessly, swung her through, and set her down. There you go, honey, he said. Hope you're happy. Mildred said,
Well, aren't you going to kiss, too? That's all part of it.
Callahan and Archer exchanged nervous glances.
Sure,
said Callahan. She leaned over and planted a kiss on Archer. She was about to pull away, but then didn't. They wrapped their arms around each other and lingered. When they pulled apart, each looked as surprised as the other. A breathless and flushed Callahan smoothed down her dress while Archer adjusted his tie. Mildred said,
Well, you two are definitely married. I know love when I see it.
On that comment, neither Callahan nor Archer would look at the other.
There's a pot of coffee on that table over there in the morning,
said Mildred.
Let's get you signed in.
Later, after they were in their room, they took turns changing in the bathroom down the hall. Archer put on dark pajamas, and Callahan a long white sleeping gown with a slit of interesting elevation, a few fluffy feathers, and nothing on underneath. They lay in the one narrow bed, and Callahan said,
You really thought I'd just up and leave you to those killers?
He turned to the side to look at her. She did likewise, perching her cheek on her palm as she studied him. It's not like you owe me anything, Liberty.
We're friends, aren't we?
We just met.
So is there a rule that you have to know somebody a certain amount of time before they can be friends?
No.
And it seems to me that we've already shared a bunch of stuff that people who are friends their whole lives haven't.
Well, being almost killed on three separate occasions over the span of 24 hours is unusual. I'll give you that.
Do you consider yourself my friend?
Yes, I do, he said.
Okay, then it's all settled.
She lay back down, but Archer didn't move. He just watched her. She seemed to sense this because she said,
Under normal circumstances, Archer, I'd be having certain feelings for you lying here like we are, especially after that kiss.
She shot him a glance full of curiosity.
Just so you know.
Nothing remotely normal about our circumstances, but I feel the same way. Just so you know. This made her smile. She reached out a hand, and he took it. Archer lay back down, and they both fell asleep, hand in hand. Chapter 15. Archer was up early, and he brought a sleepy Callahan a cup of coffee from the pot Mildred had mentioned. After that, he took the Delahaye for a gas fill-up. When he got back, Callahan was dressed and ready to go. That's some traveling outfit, noted Archer as he observed the hip-hugging white dress that fell to above her knee and showed enough cleavage to make a man temporarily forget his name. Her heels were high in the color of lavender, and the slim leather belt around her waist was black. Her hair fell to her shoulders, and her head was topped by a turban, the color of which matched her shoes.
If I'm going to be a star, I have to look the part. So, you think I look okay?
That would not be the adjective I would use.
What would be the adjective?
She asked, her eyes lifting to meet his gaze. I think I'll keep that to myself.
And I have to compete with that damn car. I feel like such a second billing.
Don't worry. Guys like cars, but they like beautiful women better.
That's the nicest thing you've said to me all morning, Archer. Now let's blow this joint.
He was loading the bags into the trunk of the Delahaye as a prowler drifted by. The two cops inside gave the Delahaye and then Archer long looks before floating onto the next street. By the time they were about to drive off, the prowler had drifted back downstream and docked next to them. The passenger side window was cranked down, revealing the meaty face of a guy in his 40s with a clean-shaven slab of skin that was sunburned and windburned around the neck and forehead. His brown hair was cut close to the scalp. Archer thought he might be ex-military. His shoulders were wide enough to swallow the window on the prowler. His partner was tall and reedy, and seemed not nearly as interested in them as Meaty was.
"Nice car," said the cop.
"Yeah, isn't it?" replied Archer with a friendly grin. He wanted this to go only one way, when it could so easily go the other.
"Where'd you get something like that?"
Meaty had apparently read the name located on the chrome front of the car, because he said,
Delahaye? What the hell is that?"
"French made, but it was built for an Englishman, which is why the steering wheel's on this side."
"Where'd you get it, pal?"
Archer had been expecting this, and said, "From a collector over in Reno. He had some money setbacks and needed to sell."
"You look pretty young to have the dough to lay down for this piece of chrome."
"Yeah, it was a sweetheart deal, but I have to keep paying on it for a while." The cop pushed back his cap and thought about this, his eyes going back and forth, and then reaching to Archer's eyes and holding like the searchlight bolted to the side of the prowler. Archer didn't like that look. It was probing and distrustful, and seemed to be angling for any reason to bust his head open and put the cuffs on. Pretty much every cop he'd ever run into had, at some point, given him that very same look.
"You got papers to prove that?"
"If you really need me to get them, yeah." The cop's features turned to stone at this slight pushback, and the glare he shot Archer was all official and aggressive, and the look of a dog who just found a dinosaur bone to crack open and then devour.
"Let me tell you something, buddy," he began sharply.
Callahan stuck her head around Archer's.
"Are you from Coalinga, officer?"
She smacked him with an ear-to-ear smile. He eyed her features and grinned.
"Born and bred, ma'am."
"I'm from back east, but I wouldn't have minded growing up here."
"Yes, ma'am."
Then the cop's grin faded as he looked at the Delahaye's damaged windscreen post where the bullet had struck. Next, his gaze dropped to the door panel and held there. His expression grew even more serious. Felony serious, thought Archer, who was noting every changing nuance of this little confrontation.
"What the hell is that?"
the cop asked, pointing. Archer dropped his gaze and saw it. His first instinct was to hit the gas. His second was to look up to see the cop watching him closely.
"Looks like blood to me," said the cop. "What's it look like to you, mister?"
Archer knew that blood was exactly what it was. The car had been parked in the picnic area near the shootout. The blast from the shotgun had obviously driven some of the dead man's blood spatter onto the Delahaye's metal. Archer hadn't noticed it in the dark, and for some reason hadn't noticed it in the light of morning either. It was, unfortunately, clearly revealed to him now. "We hit something on the road last night. A deer, a coyote, some animal. Banged the windscreen, and then I guess it brushed the side of the car."
"But no dent,"
said the cop, getting out to look closer. His buddy joined him, coming around the side of the prowler, his hand on the butt of his leather-holstered Colt 45. He looked like he wanted something to shoot.
"You'd expect a dent, right, Jimmy?"
Meaty said, looking at his partner, who had an Adam's apple so pronounced it looked like a tumor.
"Ain't no dent that I can see. You hit a deer or a big cat, you're gonna have a dent, or at least some paint scratches, yes, sir. Something weird going on here. I got me some questions, mister."
He bent down to look closer, while Jimmy kept his distance, probably in case he had to draw and shoot Archer on the fly. Meaty looked up and said,
"Step out of the car, buddy."
It was right then that Callahan got out of the car and came around to them. Both cops took a whiff of her nectary perfume and came to rigid attention, like a bailiff had just called the court to order. Archer was gratified that their full focus was on the lady and her tight dress, rather than the blood and absence of dents.
"I was driving at the time when we hit something. Scared the bejesus out of me,"
she said.
"Didn't it?"
she added, looking at Archer.
"The bejesus," repeated Archer.
"Bejesus? That's an Irish term," said Meaty. "Hey, are you Irish, miss?"
She put out a gloved hand for him to shake.
"Name's Callahan. Liberty Callahan. So that would be a yes. I am most definitely Irish, officer."
His grin threatened to run off both sides of his face. He pointed to the name sewn onto his uniform.
"I'm Sean. Sean Regan. My parents came from the county of Offaly."
"My grandparents were from Cork."
"Talk about a small world."
He turned and looked at his partner.
"Hell, Jimmy, this gal's family's from Cork."
Jimmy couldn't take his gaze off Callahan's prominent bosom. "Cork," was all he managed to say. Archer noted that Callahan stood so that she was entirely blocking the door panel.
"I'm heading to Hollywood. I want to be in the pictures."
She put a hand on her hip and bumped it out and placed the other hand behind her long neck, turned into a profile shot, curved that long neck back like a swan's, and hit them with a dazzling smile.
"Think I have a shot? Tell me the truth now, fellas."
Regan said, "Hell, your lot's prettier than Rita Hayworth."
He glanced down at her stockinged legs.
"Ain't that right, Jimmy?"
Jimmy looked like he had downed two bottles of Old Forester as a warm-up to really hitting the juice.
"Cork,"
he said throatily. Jimmy was down for the count, Archer concluded. He'd probably forgotten about his Colt 45, or the fact that he was even a cop. And Regan wasn't far behind.
"You are so sweet."
She gave Regan a hug, and Archer watched the cop's hands slide down to her buttocks. He made his landing and dug into her soft flesh. She made no attempt to move his fingers back to a respectable spot. Archer had to appreciate the lady's self-control. When Callahan stepped back, she said,
"I was so nervous, but you've cheered me up to no end. So thank you, and now I'll let you go on your way. I know how important police work is. My uncle's a cop in Boston."
Regan beamed.
"Now there's a big city, all right. They say on St. Paddy's Day, every bar in Boston gives free drinks to every Irishman. Is that true?"
"Every Irishman and Irish woman,"
she added, giving him another broadside of a smile fired right from the biggest quarterdeck cannon she had. He chuckled and tipped his cap at her.
"Best of luck to you, Ms. Callahan."
She did a little curtsy.
"Thank you kindly, Officer Regan."
They climbed into the prowler. Regan gave one more enthusiastic wave, and they were gone. Just like that. It was hard for Archer to believe everything that had just happened was not a byproduct of his imagination or a drunken binge. Callahan watched them until they were out of sight, and then got back in, tugging her dress sharply so the hem wouldn't get caught in the door as she closed it.
"Okay, now I'm convinced," said Archer.
She looked at him curiously.
"Of what?"
"That you actually might make a go of it as an actress."
"That wasn't acting, Archer. That was just lying."
"Isn't it the same thing?"
"I don't know. I've done a lot of one, but not necessarily the other."
"I was lucky about the Irish thing."
"What lucky? I saw Regan's name sewn into his uniform. And I am Irish. I thought I would give it a shot. What could we lose, right?"
"Is your family from Cork?"
"Hell, who knows? Now let's get out of here before that dumb Mick forgets the pleasure of grabbing my ass and remembers the blood and no dent. So hit it."
And so Archer hit it. Chapter 16. Hours later, Callahan awoke with a start and looked over at Archer. Only he wasn't there. The car was empty except for her. The Delahaye was pulled off to the side of the road, next to a river. She looked out the window and saw Archer skimming rocks across the water. She slipped her heels back on and got out, walking carefully over to him across the uneven terrain.
"What are you doing?"
she asked.
"Just taking a break. You were asleep. Seemed like a good time to stop."
He reached down and picked up an opened bottle of Coke.
"Got this back in Kolinga at the filling station. Just cooled it in the river for a few minutes."
She took the bottle from him and took a couple of swallows before handing it back.
"So, where are we?"
Salinas Valley. He pointed at the water. That's the Salinas River. Its mouth is way up at Monterey Bay.
It's beautiful around here.
It's farmland, and very fertile. Nearly 100 miles of it in the valley. Mountains on both sides. They raise a lot of crops here.
Were you a farmer?
Never plowed a field a day in my life. But I can read. You ever heard of the Grapes of Wrath?
I saw the movie. Henry Fonda, right?
Right. At first it was a novel by a fellow named John Steinbeck. The title comes from a line in the song, The Battle Hymn of the Republic. Read it when I was in college. He took a drink of the Coke. It's about the Jode family. The Depression and the Dust Bowl wiped out their farming prospects in Oklahoma, so they gathered all the possessions they had left, converted their sedan into a rattling truck, and set off for California for a better life. Now Callahan looked interested.
Well, hell, that's what we're doing.
She took the Coke from him and took another swallow before handing it back and settling her gaze in the rushing water and the picturesque land beyond. He continued. The trip didn't turn out too well. Some died on the way, and when they got to where they were going, the good-paying jobs turned out not to exist, at least for them. The Jodes fell on hard times. It got pretty bad.
Well, then, I'm surprised you want to go anywhere near California.
There's a line in the book I'm partial to.
What is it?
How can you frighten a man whose hunger is not only in his own cramped stomach, but in the wretched bellies of his children? You can't scare him. He has known a fear beyond every other.
So, what fear beyond every other have you known, Archer?
Archer handed her the Coke and spun a beauty of a six-skipper over the face of the Salinas as the sun blazed down on them. He tipped his hat back. Life, really, Liberty. Just life. How about you? She gave him a look that was between a sob and a smirk.
Hell, Archer, I'm a woman. So yeah, I can say the same.
Archer was about to skip another rock, but then let it drop. He put his hands in his pockets and stared out over the water.
Don't leave me in suspense, Archer. How'd it really end for the Jodes? Were they all dead? Or did it turn into a fairy tale and they woke up rich?
Some of them fought back, tried to do the right thing, organize labor, that sort of thing, fight the rich men, sort of like trying to beat a Sherman tank with a pistol for all the good it'll do you. But if a man doesn't even try...
Or a woman, Archer,
she said firmly. Or a woman, he conceded.
So was the trip worth it for them?
I guess any trip is worth taking if standing still isn't an option.
So why aren't we moving then?
They were walking back to the car when Callahan noticed it.
The blood on the door is gone.
Why do you think I stopped by the river? A rag and water equals no blood.
Smart thinking, Archer.
They got back on the road, and very soon they entered the Santa Lucia Mountains. As the land rose around them, Archer looked over at Callahan as she closed her eyes and gripped the seat again. You know, for a tough lady like you who knows her way around a gun, I'm surprised anything scares you. We could have used you in the Eighth Army. You're a better shot than a bunch of the guys I served with.
Flattery will only get you so far with me.
But she opened her eyes and smiled at him.
And where I grew up, the land was pretty flat. I don't really care for this.
How'd you get to Reno?
Trains and buses, and hitching rides when my money ran out, which it did pretty regularly.
That can be dangerous for a gal on her own.
Yes, it can, Archer,
she said, but did not elaborate. We're glad you made it. She gazed out the windscreen.
I didn't really run into any mountains on the way.
She looked at him.
But I guess there's always something in the way of where you want to go.
Well, once we clear these mountains, we'll be able to see the Pacific coast and the ocean. This perked Callahan up.
Really?
The mountains affect the weather coming west from the Pacific. Lot wetter on the coast side. Learned that while I was out here training. You'll see the plants and trees and things are a lot different on the western-facing slopes. The mountains bump the weather systems. They drop their rain and then head over the peaks. They call it the rain shadow effect. It's drier in the Salinas Valley because of that. They have to irrigate a lot from local water sources, although they do get some rain. They cleared the top of a peak on the winding road and started down. They passed coastal redwoods, ponderosa pine, fir trees, Pacific madronus, and cypress.
Later, at a lower level, they rounded a curve, and Archer said, "And there's the Pacific." Callahan actually sat on her haunches on the seat, one hand clutched on her turban, as she surveyed the breadth of the largest body of water in the world.
"That whole thing is the Pacific?"
she exclaimed. "Well, you can only see a little bit of it from here. Keep going straight west and you'll hit Japan. Same ocean, though." Her expression was one of unbridled wonder.
"Jesus, that's something, Archer. I thought that Lake Tahoe was big."
"A drop in the bucket."
"Gosh, it's just swell. I mean, really swell."
He eyed her sitting on her haunches, looking like a little girl who'd just been shown the most beautiful doll in the world and then been told it was all hers. He next eyed the glove box where the 38th Special that had killed a man sat. He wondered about the complexities of human beings in general, and this woman in particular.
"How much farther to Baytown?"
she asked, finally resettling in her seat. "We head out of the mountains, and I think the rest of the drive is out along the coast." He slowed the car, and then stopped on the shoulder. He popped open the glove box and took out a map and unfolded it. He studied the route while she watched him. "Yep, along the coast. It looks to be a few hours. If we could rev the Delahaye up, we'd be there in no time. But from the looks of the route, we won't be going that fast."
"And it'll be pretty flat?"
"Pretty flat," she said.
"Well, hallelujah for small miracles."
"Are there any other kind?" he said. Chapter 17. Coming down the steep Santa Ynez Mountains, they entered the vibrant-looking town that was perched like a gargoyle right on the coast. "Welcome to Baytown," said the sign, "where a good life begins."
"Place seems to think a lot of itself,"
Callahan remarked. They reached a wide boulevard named Sawyer Avenue and admired the row of fine homes there.
"Nice places, but they don't look cheap,"
she said.
"Do you have somewhere lined up to stay?"
"Rooming house on Porter Street."
"Think they got room for one more?"
"We can always ask."
"Or do you want to play the husband and wife routine again? You could carry me over the threshold. Of course, we'd have to do the kissing thing,"
she added, giving him a sharp, hopeful glance. "That might be a little awkward now that I'm making this place my home."
"Oh, you take all the fun out of everything,"
Callahan replied, but she smiled to show she wasn't serious. Archer stopped and asked a woman walking her dog where Porter Street might be. She told him and then said,
"What kind of car is that? Steering wheel's on the wrong side."
"French," said Archer. The woman looked at him funny.
"French? How'd it get to America?"
"We drove it over,"
said Callahan.
"It turns into a boat when you press that button,"
she added, pointing to a knob on the dash.
"Well, isn't that something?"
said the woman.
"You sure are,"
said Callahan, as Archer pulled off with a grin. He hung a left and headed up a steeply ascending road.
"When do you meet with that private eye who's going to teach you all the dirty tricks you'll need to be a full-fledged Seamus?"
asked Callahan. "I was going to call him when I got in and arrange to meet him."
"What was the name again?"
"Willie Dash."
"That Willie Dash?"
She was pointing at a large faded sign pasted on the side of a brick building. On it was the image of a short, broad-shouldered man in his late 40s with a pugnacious expression, dressed in an old-fashioned pinstripe suit and sporting a fedora worn at a sharp angle on his wide head. He was pointing a sausage finger apparently at the world in general. The words written below him read, "Got a problem needs solving? Private Eye Willie Dash is your man." After that was a 5-digit phone number, but no address. It was the same phone number as on Archer's letter from the man. Archer stopped the car and looked up at the sign, gaping. "Yeah, that Willie Dash. I thought he'd be older, but he came highly recommended."
"Yeah, and who recommended the guy who recommended him?"
Archer drove on without answering her. They pulled to a stop in front of the rooming house, a broad building with a narrow front porch, wood siding painted gray, red shutters, and a peaked metal roof the color of olive green. It looked old and seemed to be slightly leaning to one side. A sign out front said there were vacancies.
"My lucky day,"
remarked Callahan as she noted this.
but we might have to spend half our time holding the sucker up.
They took out their bags and walked up to the front porch. The screen door opened, revealing a woman standing there. She was 70 if she was a day. Her rimless specs made her small eyes enormous. One pupil hugged the inner wall of its socket. She had on a threadbare sweater over a homemade dress that dipped below her knee. She eyed with a certain disdain the turbaned Callahan in her tailor-made outfit.
"Can I help you?"
she said sharply. "Name's Archer. I have a room reserved."
"Yes, I already have you on the books."
She eyed Callahan.
"And who might this be?"
"This might be Liberty Callahan. I need a room, too."
"For how long?"
"I'll have to let you know. My plans are what you call fluid."
The woman glanced past them to the Delahaye, and her already giant eyes became the size of a full moon.
"Is that your car?"
"Yes, ma'am," said Archer.
"It's a Delahaye."
Surprised, Archer said, "Yes, it is. How'd you know?"
"I'm French. I came over long before the war. I don't really sound French anymore, do I?"
"No, ma'am, you don't." She looked upset by this.
"Well, that's my problem, isn't it? J'ai perdu la beauté de ma culture. Je suis américain maintenant."
"If you say so," replied Archer.
"And you are?"
asked Callahan.
"You may call me Madame Genevieve."
"You're married, then?" said Archer.
"Not anymore,"
she said. "I'm sorry."
"I'm not. Come in and sign the register, and I'll show you to your rooms. I take a week's rent in advance. No exceptions."
"Seems like a nice town. You like it here?" asked Archer.
"I like it fine. If I didn't, I wouldn't stay."
She turned and walked off down the hall. Archer and Callahan exchanged a glance, and then followed. Chapter 18. Archer took a moment to look around the small room that he would be calling home, at least for a while. Everything in it was old, but the place was spotless and smelled of soap and furniture polish. He pocketed the large metal key, put his suitcase down, dropped his hat on the small bed, and went over to the rear window. His immediate view was the back of another building, but rising behind that and the rest of Baytown were the St. Inez Mountains. The high rock dwarfed the town like Goliath had David. But then look who won that fight. He crossed the room and looked out the front window. They weren't on the ocean side of town, but the elevated position of the boarding house allowed an unobstructed view of the Pacific. To the right of that was a long wharf where ships were docked, and Archer could see large cranes either taking off or loading on cargo. Men swarmed around this operation like ants on a hunt. Archer knew that directly up the coast was the Army's Camp Cook. Farther down, he saw a couple of oil derricks bowing and straightening like ostriches pecking for food as they lifted black gold from the earth. He knew off the coast and farther to the south were the Channel Islands. Archer unknotted his tie, pulled his flask, and took a sip of his rye. It quenched his thirst just enough to persuade him to take another belt. From his suitcase, he hung up the clothes that needed hanging and put away the others in the chest of drawers stacked against one wall. They held the scent of Murphy's oil soap, a product he'd often used in prison to clean his own cell. He would have to find a board and an iron to press everything. He went back downstairs and out to the Delahaye after finding out from Madame Genevieve where he could park the car. He drove it into a two-bay garage behind the boarding house. After that, he went back up to his room, took off his jacket and shirt and undershirt, but kept his pants and shoes on. He had just lighted a lucky when someone rapped on his door. Callahan had taken off her turban, but was otherwise dressed the same. She came in without invitation and looked at his space.
"Seems every room is the same."
"Nice views." She eyed his bare torso.
"Yeah, they are nice. Hey, where'd you get all those big muscles, Archer?"
"Sears and Roebuck. They were having a sale. Got them cheap." She slid a hand along his right shoulder and down his arm. Archer breathed in her perfume, but remained unbowed by conjuring the image of her shooting a man dead. She said,
"Remind me to place an order with them sometime. The quality is really good."
She slowly slid her fingers free, but scraped his bare skin with her nails as she did so.
What's up? He asked.
I put my things away, and now I'm bored.
We just got here, Liberty.
I've got a low tolerance for having nothing to do. I need to find a place to work.
I can ask around.
I already did that.
When? He asked in a surprised voice.
Madame Genevieve said there is a place outside of town, like a burlesque theater. It's called Midnight Moods. She said it sounded right up my alley.
How would she know what was up your alley?
She's already got her opinion of me, Archer, after one look and 2 minutes of conversation. Women tend to do that a lot faster than men. She sees me, I'm sure, as what she would call a loose lady. And maybe I am. And I don't really care what she thinks. But I do care about supporting myself. Maybe you can drive me over there at some point, and I can see if they need a new girl.
Sounds like a plan.
Hey, you want to take me to lunch?
No, but I'll take you to dinner.
Okay. See you around, Archer.
She went back to her room. Archer put on his undershirt and grabbed a letter from Willie Dash. Then he walked down to the main floor and slipped into the phone box in the small foyer just outside the rectangular-shaped dining area. He closed the booth door, dropped in his coin, and dialed the number. A moment later,
Willie Dash, very private investigations,
said a female voice. Hello, this is Archer. I'm in town. I'd like to set up a time to meet with Mr. Dash today.
Yes, Mr. Archer. This is Connie Morrison. I'm Mr. Dash's secretary.
Nice talking to you, Miss Morrison. So when can I see him? He heard paper being shuffled.
He has an opening now if you want to come by.
Archer checked his timepiece. I'm staying over at a boarding house on Porter Street down by the wharf. How long do you reckon it would take me to get there?
Depends. Do you have a car?
I do.
Then 10 minutes should do it. Do you have our address?
Yeah, it's on the letter, 1533 Encino Street. She gave him directions and added,
It's a 4-story brick office building with a green awning out front. We're on the top floor, suite 401.
Thanks. I saw one of his billboards in town.
I'm sure you did, but they're pretty old.
I'll see you shortly. He rushed back to his room and put on a fresh shirt, wound a tie around his neck, lined his pocket square just so, and angled his hat the same. He was bouncing down the stairs when she called out.
Good luck, Seamus-to-be.
He looked back up to see Callahan standing at the top of the stairs. She had taken her dress off and was wearing a pale blue robe that hung only to mid-thigh and was clingy enough to get Archer's undivided attention. In her right hand she held a lit cigarette, its burning muzzle pointed straight down. He made a show of checking his watch. You look like you're going to bed, he said. She played with the belt in the front of the robe.
Then I'd have to take off all my clothes.
That surely won't take you long. Her fingers undid the knot in the belt. The panels of the robe parted ever so slightly. Archer let that sink in and said, You trying to seduce me?
Not trying, no.
You told me good luck. How do you know where I'm going? She said,
I don't need the world's greatest gumshoe to figure that one out. You have the look of a guy just itching to get going.
Okay. Maybe you should go see Willie Dash about the job instead of me.
Dressed as I am, you probably think I'm just a floozy with a bottle of hooch behind my back, and pegging you as a sucker I briefly need for a good time.
I don't think you're anything like a floozy unless you're pretending to be one. And I don't need to be the world's greatest gumshoe to deduce that the only thing behind your back is you.
Well, aren't you a true gentleman to notice?
You know you should charge for all this.
Oh, I do, handsome. You just haven't gotten the bill yet.
She blew Archer a kiss, turned, and sauntered away. After her door closed, Archer slapped his face hard to stun himself out of everything he was feeling, and it was a lot. All he wanted to do was run upstairs to her. But instead he walked off to take care of business. Maybe you're finally growing up, Archer. It's about time. Chapter 19 Archer climbed into the Delahaye, turned the key, thumbed the starter button, and put the car in gear. Heads turned to stare at the car as he followed the precise directions Morrison had given him, and he made it to Encino Street in short order. The buildings down this way seemed a lot older than others he had passed, and they became dingier still the longer he was on it. The very last building was Dash's, and it was the dingiest of all.
It looked like something erected at the end of the last century merely as an afterthought. Mortar splotches had permanently stained its brick surface. The green awning that covered its entrance was torn, with a sleeve of it flapping in the stiffening ocean breeze. The sidewalk in front was missing a few chunks, like teeth punched out of a mouth. He parked the car in front of the entrance and opened the single glass door, finding himself in a tiny lobby that smelled of stale tobacco, spilled gin, and a few odd odors that he couldn't readily place, but made his nose crinkle in displeasure. The space was badly lighted, and he had to blink a few times to transition his pupils from daylight to enforced dusk. There was an occupant register on the wall. Though he knew the suite number, Archer wanted to check out who his potential neighbors might be. It didn't take him long. There were only 12 suites in the building, 3 on each floor, and only 4 were currently occupied. The other 8 had vacant next to them. There was a doctor on the first floor by the name of Myron O'Donnell. On the second floor was a chap named Bradley Wanamaker, attorney at law. Dash was on the top floor, along with a business called Gemology Incorporated. There was no girl at the tiny reception desk in the lobby. A dusty telephone switchboard sat in one corner. There were no cobwebs covering it, but there easily could have been. Archer saw the sign for the elevator and headed that way. He figured the stairs would be in the same direction. Ever since being in prison, he did not like small, enclosed spaces where he could not open the door when he wanted to. He came to the single elevator, where a black man who looked to be about 100, wearing an ill-fitting gray bellhop's uniform with white piping down the legs and arms, sat on a small, ragged, pillow-topped, wooden drop-down seat just inside the car, reading a nickel copy of the Baytown Gazette. It was short and too thin, with hands that bent upward, apparently against their owner's will, because he held the paper in an awkward grip. The unlit, short, cheap stogie in his mouth was rolling from one side to the other with delicate flicks of his tongue. With an effort, he put the paper aside, sat on it, and said,
"What floor, young man?"
"It's okay, I'll take the stairs." He scratched his nose and looked interested.
"Give me something to do if you let me take you. My first customer all day."
"Aren't Willie Dash and his secretary here?" The man grinned.
"Hell, they don't count. They work here. I need me some fresh smiling faces like yours. Keeps me going. You going to see Willie?"
Archer nodded.
"Fourth floor. Suite 401. Let's get to it, young man."
Archer hesitated for a moment, glancing at the wooden door with a wired pane of glass leading to the stairs for a few moments, until the man said,
"Time waits for no man, mister. And don't I know it. I'll be worm food before long."
Archer stepped on. The man closed the cage door and then hit the button for the fourth floor, which automatically closed the car's outer solid metal door. Archer sucked in a breath and felt his body stiffen and his pulse race. He shut his eyes and pretended he was outside, with all sorts of possibilities for escape. The man had swiveled around in his seat and stared at him as the car began its glacial ascent of 30 or so feet.
"When's you get out, friend?"
asked the man with a knowing look. Archer opened his eyes. The old fellow smiled, showing off perfectly white teeth, and all of them real as far as Archer could tell. "Get out of where?" The fellow snorted.
"Come on, don't BS me. The joint, man."
"How do you figure that?"
"How do I not figure it, you mean? Been inside myself, lots of times. Altogether, longer than you've been alive. And carried lots of men up to see Willie who got the elevator disease, same as you. Stair doors you can open all by yourself."
He tapped the cage.
"Not like these. Remind you of bars, don't they?"
"Does it go away?"
"Look at me. I live in a goddamn elevator, son."
"How long did it take you?"
"I won't say, 'cause I don't want to discourage you."
"I got on, didn't I?" retorted Archer.
"Sure you did. Now stop sweating and looking like you're gonna puke and we getting somewhere."
Archer put a hand against the wall. "What can you tell me about Willie Dash?" The man picked up his paper, but his brown eyes stayed on Archer.
"What you want to know?"
"What kind of a man is he?"
"You looking to hire him?"
"No, work for him." This surprised the man. He took a moment to light up his stogie,
sticking the burned match in a metal cup that stuck out from the wall of the car.
Work for him? What, you a baby Seamus or something?
Something like that.
Well, Willie is getting up there, all right. Can't be doing this forever.
But he's good at what he does? The man puffed on the cigar to get it going as the car slowly moved past the second floor and began its assault on the third.
You know he was a G-man with Hoover's boys before he left to be a cop in Frisco.
No, I didn't know that.
He was one of the best. Worked with that there Elliot Ness.
Why'd he leave? The man shrugged.
Who knows? Why'd he leave Frisco to come here and be a private dick?
So he's really good, then? The man smiled slyly.
Hell, he caught me. It was his second day on the job as a detective in Frisco, and he nailed my ass.
For doing what?
Held up a liquor store. Done my time at San Quentin. I don't recommend it, son. Death row there. Used to hang 'em. Now they gas 'em.
Either way, you're dead, said Archer.
Now, Willie put in a real good word for me, so I didn't get nearly as long a sentence as I might have, and then I got time off for good behavior, and I was getting up there age-wise, and they needed more room for younger bad guys needing prison beds. It was Willie got me a job here after I left prison.
So he kept in touch after you went into the joint?
Visited me at the prison a few times. Said I did what I did because I was down and out and the wrong color. All stuff I knew. Hell, I'm a Mississippi boy. Only thing the police do down south is march in parades on July 4th and shoot folks look like me. Why I got out of the south. But I ain't find it all that different no matter where I go. Figured robbing a place might get me 3 squares and a roof over my head, so I hit that liquor store. But Willie said I could make an honest living if I wanted to.
So you came down here and climbed into this car?
No. Willie got me a job at the docks, loading shit on and taking shit off the boats. Did that for years.
He held up his gnarled hands.
Where I got these. Then Willie got me this sitting job when I couldn't lift the shit no more. I can still poke a button and close a gate, see?
Did that surprise you? I mean, what he did for you?
Nothing surprises me, young man. Not no more. You live to be my age, and you colored to boot? Life ain't got no more surprises. Except why no white man ain't shot me dead at some point along the way for no reason except he wanted to, see?
A minute later, the slow-moving car passed the third floor and settled into the homestretch. What about his gal, Connie Morrison? The old man cackled.
Connie? They used to be hitched.
Archer shook out a lucky. The old man struck a match and lit it for him before depositing the spent match in the chromium cup. So they were married, but not anymore?
That's right. Think Willie was married way back to some gal when he was a G-man, but guess that didn't work out. Pretty sure he's done walking down the aisle now. Not sure about Connie. She's 42, which is long in the tooth for getting hitched. But maybe some man'll snatch her up.
What's your name, by the way?
Earl. You?
Archer. So if I go to work for him, what's your advice?
Go in with both eyes and ears open and pray that's enough.
Think he can teach me stuff?
He's forgotten more about gumshoeing than you'll ever know, young man. No offense.
With a jolt and a hiss, they reached the fourth floor, and Earl slid open the cage door. When the outer door disappeared into the wall, Archer quickly stepped through and gratefully sucked in even the stale air at his sudden freedom. Earl poked his head out.
Down the hall and to the left, Archer. Good luck to you.
At this point in my life, you'd think I wouldn't need so much damn luck, muttered Archer, as he headed on to meet ex-G-man and former copper Willie Dash. Chapter 20. The door was pebbled glass with painted letters on its surface that spelled out, Willie Dash, Very Private Investigations. The image of a lawman's 5-point star was etched below this, as though to lend gravitas to the entry point, a certain officialness. Or maybe it had been thrown in for the price of the name above, mused Archer. The doorknob was brass and looked worn down, probably by the thousands of nervous, sweaty hands that had touched it, looking for some help of a very private nature. The door was locked. He noted the buzzer next to the door and pressed it.
Yes?
Said the voice from the little intercom screen.
It's Archer.
Archer heard a lock click free. He turned the knob and swung the door open. 6 feet directly across from him was, presumably, Connie Morrison. He could have laid flat on the floor, his hat against one wall, and the bottom of his shoes would have touched her desk. Morrison was a honey blonde with shoulder-length hair parted in the middle, with the sides winging their way down. The lady was sitting behind a carved oak desk that looked like it had come over on the Mayflower and gotten wet along the way. Archer took in the small reception area. 4 walls, 1 window, 5 dented metal file cabinets with alphabet letters on their fronts, and a square of faded carpet that was so worn it looked like the plank floor had reclaimed it. There was a fuzzy light overhead and a table lamp with a patterned shade on the desk. A Royal typewriter about the size of a Sherman tank sat on the desk in front of her with a black blotter underneath that. A jar of finely sharpened pencils was near her elbow, along with a stapler and a roll of tape in its holder. A Boston sharpener bolted to the wall just behind her and standing ready to take care of all those yellow number 2s completed this dream of an office setup. On the walls were diplomas and certificates from places Archer had never heard of, and framed photos of people he didn't know, except for President Harry S., the buck stops here Truman, dressed in a cream suit and a dotted bow tie, who smiled all alone from one wall. A rubber tree that looked fake and still somehow dead leaned out of a blue and white ceramic planter with an elephant on it that sat next to the desk. When Morrison rose and came around to the front of the desk, Archer could see that she wore a blue tailor-made suit dress and that she was medium height and thin. She had fine lines all over her chiseled face, like the depth markings on a shipping channel map. Morrison slipped on a pair of rimless cheaters that she was holding in her hand. They accentuated the woman's eyes, which Archer decided were closer to periwinkle blue than any other blue he knew of. They were slightly washed out, as were the woman's features. Her heels were black and matched the color of her hosiery and added about 2 inches of height to her frame. A slender platinum watch graced her left wrist. A dark hat with a blue ribbon was on a wall hook. A tan raincoat hung next to it, though there wasn't a cloud in the sky. Next to that hung a dented crown fedora with a blood-red ribbon. He assumed that belonged to Willie Dash. He tipped his hat in greeting as she reached him.
Mr. Archer, nice to meet you.
Her long fingers managed a grip that was firm and reassuring, her expression less so. The periwinkles took him in as thoroughly as his gaze had done her. She seemed to come away impressed, although that could have simply been Archer's wishful thinking. Nice to meet you, Miss Morrison. I'm really hoping I can go to work for Mr. Dash. The periwinkles dulled a bit, and the firm jaw clenched even tighter, and the lines around her eyes and mouth deepened into ditches.
Yes. Give me a minute. We've had a, development since you called.
She turned and left him there, opening and then quickly closing the door to the interior office, where Archer was certain Willie Dash bided his professional time. A development since I called 10 minutes ago? He took off his hat, twirled it between his fingers, and took a long, slow loop around the room, arriving at the Royal typewriter and the paper wound into its maw that had clickety-clack marks all over it. He bent over to read the typing better. It was addressed to the First National Bank of Baytown. Dear Mr. Weaver, due to my recent illness coupled with a sudden downturn in business, I will be unable to meet my payment obligations on the loan to your institution in the near term. I would like to discuss a different payment plan that might... The words ended here. Archer slid back around the desk as the inner office door opened, and Morrison appeared once more. She wouldn't meet his eye, but said,
Mr. Dash, we'll see you now, Mr. Archer.
Great. Everything okay?
She lifted her elegant chin and dead-eyed him with the periwinkles that had instantly hardened to glowing bits of molten iron.
Why shouldn't it be okay?
She glanced sharply at her typewriter. Archer said, You mentioned developments. I took that as maybe there was a problem. My mistake. Sorry. The fire in the eyes dimmed, and the periwinkles sparkled back at him.
No apology necessary.
She held the door open for him. He passed by her and went in. He heard the door close firmly behind him, and listened to the efficient heels of Connie Morrison marching the short distance back to her desk to finish her boss's letter of developments.
Next, Archer heard a belch, and swiveled his attention to a battleship-sized dark walnut desk that turned out to not have a single sailor on board. This office was 3 times the size of the outer room, but seemed far smaller because it was crammed with so much stuff Archer wasn't sure whether he was in a private eye's office or a fence's warehouse. Against one wall was a Murphy bed that was in the down position. It was neatly made up with 2 pillows plumped on its surface like white geese on a rectangular pond.
"Keep your eyes looking, Archer. You'll get there, son."
Archer did as the voice suggested, and came to rest on the man lying shoeless on a pale blue davenport. His cuffed pants were held up by white plastic suspenders rather than a belt or leather braces. His collar was undone, and his blue dotted bow tie hung off limply to one side of his neck like a broken arm dangling. His broad face was flushed, and his scalp was as bald as a cue ball and close to the same color, which provided an odd and unsettling juxtaposition. His white shirt was wrinkled beyond perhaps the remediation of an iron, and one of his dark socks needed darning where his little toe poked out like a hatching chick. His eyes were cloudy gray, like the color of a naval ship. They seemed to peer right through Archer. On the coffee table in front of the davenport was a bottle of Jim Beam Kentucky bourbon and 2 glasses, one of which had been used. A newspaper lay next to them.
"Willie Dash, sir. Come on and take a seat and let me have a closer look at you."
Archer crossed the room and noted the plank floor was worn smooth, perhaps from a man pacing in his socks for a number of years. He sat down, placed his hat next to the beam, and leaned forward, his elbows resting on his knees, waiting. Dash had a line of sweat on his broad forehead, each drop perfectly lined up with its neighbor, blackbirds on a phone line. When he opened his mouth wide, Archer saw 2 porcelain crowns, one on either side and occupying the lower back 40. A grinder who has worn down his grinders. "You live here?" said Archer, eyeing the bed.
"I sleep here sometimes. Depends on the job. This ain't no 9-to-5er, son. You want that life? Go apply at the bank to count other people's money and be bored to death for the next 40 years.
"So how are developments?" asked Archer. "Things looking up or still down? To put it as squarely as I can, will you be able to hire me if I pass muster?" With an effort, Dash sat up and swung his short, thick legs down to the floor. The toes touched, but not the heels. He was no more than 5'7", but his burly build looked strong. He wasn't much under 200 pounds. His age was difficult to say. Archer thought over 60 rather than under.
"I like your directness, Archer. It's good up until it's not so good. And you eyeballed the letter in Connie's typewriter because she sure wouldn't have told you. That shows initiative and a certain disregard for the rules. Both okay in my book, and maybe essential to the task."
He pulled a handkerchief from his pants pocket, hawked into it, and set it down next to him.
"The developments can come later, and maybe not the ones you're thinking of. Now, Irving Shaw wrote very highly of you."
"He's a good man. Learned a lot from him."
"And you no doubt want to continue your education under me."
"I hoped my letter to you made that clear."
"You're coming in from this Polka City place? Irv told me that in his letter."
"Yes, I stopped over in Reno for a little bit and then headed west." Dash hawked once more into the cloth and sat back, lifting his feet fully off the floor.
"You got a ticket?"
"Come again?"
"A PI's license."
"Nope. Do I need one?"
"State of California says you do. Law enacted back in 1915.
"What do I have to do to get it?"
"You have to apply to the State Board of Prison Directors."
Archer felt like someone had just shivved him in the carotid.
"Prison directors?" "Yes. You have to provide background on yourself, where you were last employed, and where in the state you intend to work as a PI. And you have to provide facts that you're of good moral character. You have to sign that application, and then you have to find 5 reputable people in Baytown who will approve of the application and also sign it before an officer duly authorized to take acknowledgement of deeds."
"I don't even know 5 people in town."
and the State Board will review the application and may do its own investigation to confirm that you are indeed a person of good moral character and integrity. If they do, they will issue a license good for 5 years, and the fee is $10 a year.
Archer stared at him. And if they find out I've been in prison, will that knock out any chance of me getting my license?
It might. But there's another way.
What's that?
There's a provision in the law that allows you to act under the auspices of the license I have for this firm.
So I don't even have to apply?
But you might want to anyway sometime down the road, Archer. I won't be around forever, and the license I have is not transferable to you. And I have to tell you that there's talk of changing the law, making it even more restrictive next year. It might well require several years of apprenticing as a PI, and also require that the applicant not have been convicted of any serious crime.
Archer nodded. Okay.
So you might want to find 5 people and get yourself grandfathered in if you can. Me and Connie can be 2 of them, so you're nearly halfway home on that score. In the meantime, I can provide a ticket for you that allows you to operate under the license of this firm. I'll have Connie get going on that.
Didn't know it was so involved.
It's a profession, Archer, and it's getting all the riffraff out and making way for us professionals. I went to the CAPI conference last year, and it was quite informative.
The what?
California Association of Private Investigators had a woman named Mildred Gilmore speak. She's a licensed PI and an attorney, and good at both jobs. She argued for adopting a code of ethics for PIs. She also said that women make better operators because they're more ethical, and no one would suspect them of being PIs.
What do you think?
I've got my own ethics, and I don't want other folks telling me what they should be.
Yeah, okay.
What's your first name again?
Aloysius.
Then I'll just call you Archer.
I saw the billboards around town. Miss Morrison told me they were from a while ago.
Dash cocked his head, and the mouth flatlined.
Don't play me for a fool, son. You put up billboards to get business. Least I did when I first got here. The fact is I soon had more than enough business, so no need for more billboards. Plus, I sort of like driving around and seeing what I used to look like.
But you need business now, sounds like.
Things have slowed. I won't debate that point with you.
So you were with the FBI?
Dash poured out small measures of Beam in both glasses and nudged one toward Archer.
How is Earl? In fine form? Man loves to talk.
He thinks the world of you.
I did him one act of kindness, and he did the rest.
Nice of you after sending him to San Quentin.
Dash said sharply,
He sent himself to San Quentin. That liquor store didn't rob itself.
Right, I guess not.
And it was the Bureau of Investigation when I was there. Didn't become the FBI until 1935.
He said you worked with Elliot Ness. Is that true?
It is. But Ness worked with a lot of guys. I was just one of them.
Didn't he take down Ma Barker, Dillinger, and Machine Gun Kelly, and folks like that? Were you in on that, too?
Ancient history, Archer.
Why'd you leave?
I had my reasons.
So then you went to Frisco to be a cop?
A detective,
corrected Dash.
I grew up on the West Coast and wanted to get back here.
So why the Seamus route?
I don't like following orders, particularly if they're lousy ones, and I like being my own boss. But enough about me, Archer. How'd you find the joint?
I wasn't so different from being in the army, actually. And I was innocent, if that makes a difference to you.
Dash sipped his Beam and slowly shook his head.
Were you tried and convicted?
No, I did a deal. Otherwise, they were going to throw the book at me.
Then you were guilty?
You think all men who do a deal are guilty?
Of course I don't. Just as I know that all men who are tried and convicted aren't guilty. But it's the only system we have. Fact is, I'm not concerned with the past, Archer, yours or mine. I look toward the future.
So where does that leave us?
With a possibility. Nothing more and nothing less.
He bent over and worried at the hole in his sock, tucking the little toe out of sight before straightening.
What do you know about the detective business?
What Lieutenant Shaw taught me.
Which was?
Listen, ask questions,
Don't believe anything is true unless you can corroborate it, and don't trust anyone. He nodded approvingly.
That's a good start. Irv knows his way around an investigation, that's for sure. He said in his letter that you saved his life.
He did the same for me.
And you have a good war record.
I did my bit.
Care to talk about it?
No. He nodded approvingly again.
I fought in the First World War, the one that was supposed to end any future ones, right? Basically living in holes and only climbing out of them when the army felt it had to show it was doing something, giving folks their money's worth, so to speak.
He slapped his right leg.
Got some metal here they never took out, but I was one of the lucky ones. Left a lot of good buddies back there.
I can understand that, said Archer, sipping his drink and letting it go down as slow as possible.
What else? Asked Dash.
That fingerprints can do a man in, and the police check for that. That honest people lie all the time when they're in a jam. That sometimes it's the last person you suspect who did the deed. Dash put his glass down, sat forward so his toes were touching the planks one more, and said,
Now, this possibility I'm talking about.
Archer hunched forward and settled in to listen. The buzzer on the desk phone sounded off like a warning shot across the bow. Dash moved across the space with surprising speed and snatched up the phone. He listened for a moment and said,
Give me 1 minute, hun.
He put the phone down, stepped into his brown wingtips, which were set next to his desk, and rapidly put his collar and bow tie in place before slipping on his jacket and pinching his cheeks. Next, he opened a desk drawer, slipped out something hairy, squirted on its underside something wet from a bottle on his desk, and then plopped a black toupee on the top of his bald head. He fussed over it in the slanted shaving mirror on his desk until he came away satisfied with the look. To Archer, the thing looked like a baby skunk without a stripe.
Put the beam away in that cabinet over there, Archer, and hoist up the bed.
Archer quickly did so and said, What's up, Mr. Dash?
The possibility, Archer, the possibility has just walked in the door.